From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
You gotta fight for your right to party.
Restaurateur Ken Friedman once said, "What I do every night is throw a party." It's no surprise then that he and Chef April Bloomfield have enlisted the help of someone who fought for our right to party. That's Michael Diamond, or Mike D, of the Beastie Boys. Mike helped curate the wine list of Friedman's new restaurant, Hearth & Hound. It opens next week in Hollywood. Michael and sommelier Taylor Parsons join us to discuss what they plan to uncork. Hi, Taylor.
Hello, Evan. How are you?
Hi, Mike.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
Excellent. So, Mike, you rapped about Brass Monkey and Chivas?
Not highly esteemed alcoholic beverages.
Have you always, though, been a secret onophile?
In terms of having regrets in life, my regrets are usually that I didn't do something sooner. And discovering wine is on that list, right? I just wish that from the first time I started touring in Europe that I loved good wine, because it's such an incredible way to travel. And that's what I discovered later on in my touring life. You know, and as a touring musician, it's an incredible gift on multiple levels. But one of them is you really get to explore food and wine from region to region, and you end up with de facto tour guides, right, all around you, because you just end up sort of literally falling into people that are passionate about both.
Do you remember what your first, like, aha, like, oh my God, this is unbelievable moment was with wine? Like the first wine you truly just fell head over heels for?
I think regionally, and probably a lot of people have this, is probably traveling in Italy, because you can't separate the magic of the experience and the magic of the food and the magic of the wine, and it all sort of gets intertwined. And then, you bring a couple of cases back, and they're never as good as when you had them out on the piazza at 10 p.m. in perfect weather. That experience somehow never recurs to you when you're, like, back in your home in Silver Lake or whatever.
Context is crucial, for sure.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah.
I understand there's another team member.
Max Schnee is the person we've tapped to be the wine director of this restaurant. He's going to be the guy that's there day-to-day, and he has a huge role in shaping the program. He's been downtown at Baco Mercat and at Orson Winston, and he's a really important wine presence in LA for a little bit, and we're really excited to have him at this project.
And you, of course, were general manager at Republic for a very long time.
I did the restaurant, I did the wine, and I left in January to focus on a variety of projects, including this one.
So, Taylor, talk a bit more about the collaboration and what you're kind of looking for in terms of a point of view.
It's a great question. We're taking a lot of our cues from Ken and also from Chef April. This restaurant is the first in LA for them. April is super excited to cook the produce that's out here, to work with it. She's been a quiet evangelist about vegetables for a long time, but I think that she's pushing that more to the fore now, especially that she's here. There's a huge hearth in the restaurant, a lot of open fire cooking. It's a hybrid of Ken's wanting it to be the funnest, most partiest place in town, and then April's desire to have it be like someone's really warm and inviting home. So imagine like the greatest party you've ever been to at the coolest house you've ever been to.
Well, I think very warm living room. I have to give it to them. They've managed to take a place that's, you know, in the middle of Hollywood and simultaneously having like this very warm feeling living room vibe and this beautiful bar and this beautiful outdoor space all.
Yeah, so like warm and happening. Fun and just thinking about that. And, you know, it's long been a project of mine and as well as Max's and talking to, getting to know Mike now is, and Mike's too, that to make wine fun and to make it approachable and to make it a component at a party rather than something that people need to be intimidated about. Or we want to have this be an integrative part of this larger fabric, and we want wine to be a part of the party. And we can't do that unless we sort of break down some of the barriers that have traditionally existed. So we're excited, like April is, about working with some of the stuff that's coming out of California right now, because it's very exciting, the wines that are being produced here. We're really excited to touch with some of the old world wines that have shaped us, some of the regions that we think are classic, as well as some of the up-and-coming stuff across the pond.
I'm always fascinated by how wine lists are presented, whether it's by color, poetic, descriptive language that refers to texture, or regional. How do you think that it's going to be presented?
It's actually a great question. This is something that Max, who's not here, and Taylor and I have had a lot of dialogue about. Uh-huh. Right? Because it's funny, and that's a big, it's central to sort of our core manifesto of wanting to have really interesting, really good wines that work great with the food that April's making, but at the same time, not having it too full of, I don't want to say an expletive word here on the esteemed KCRW, but, you know, not too full of crap, right? So that it's approachable for people, but that there's like really things of high quality for people that are interested, and also making it that it's not going to take you an hour to decode it. Mm-hmm.
But I think it's, you know, we want to move away from preciousness. We want to move away from making things that are too cerebral in terms of format. And we want to move away from tomes. Like we want, the big book is dead.
It's so funny that you're saying all that because I feel like cocktails have become all of those things. Precious, cerebral,
we'll let them have that
tomes.
For now.
Everything has its cycle, right?
You know, yeah.
And wine passed through a pretty precious moment, and I think we're coming into a slightly more populist moment with wine, for better and for worse.
You know, that old Cat and Fiddle space where Hearth and Hound has taken over, that patio is so emblematic for many of us who are old. Perfect, especially for day drinking.
Yes.
Just such a great day drinking spot. And we're moving out of the warmer rosé drinking season. What are you looking forward to pouring that you think people will just sit out there on the patio and just...
Again, very good question. This is a question that Max, Taylor, and I have sat around, thought about, November opening, it's going to be cooler. People are going to, I know for myself, like I'm going to want to be out on that patio. So to answer your question, I think we talked about Rhone wines quite a bit, but there's also interesting California wines made with the same varietal of grapes with Syrah and Grenache that will fit that as well. And I think even also we talked about slightly cooled Beaujolais.
For sure.
The lighter reds, because you're kind of starting to want something heartier, more complex, more heavily spiced without, you're not all the way there yet. You're not in February, you're not in January. It's not pouring out yet, hopefully.
You know, one of the real goals of this program, and I know that Max feels this way, is we really want to encourage people to drink seasonally and to drink broadly. You know, I think there's, if you really consider it, there's very few things in life that people are so entrenched about as the beverages that they consume. I mean, people take their coffee one way only. Mm-hmm. People take they have one drink that they get out of every bar, regardless of season. They drink one kind of wine. And we want to really encourage people to just be a little bit broader. So that's part of the reason for the carafes, for having a lot of glass options, part of the reason for having great sommeliers on the floor that can talk about wine in a really approachable way. We want people to maybe start with a glass of Beaujolais and then move into a glass of something from the Northern Rhone if they want to stick with reds. We want to have a spectrum of wines available, and we want to encourage them to sample those things.
I feel like over time, Angelinos have become really imbibers of white wine more than ever. I just spent a week, you know, squiring people around Rome, in fact.
Lovely.
That I did it twice this year, and they were all, you know, Angelinos or Southern Californians. And it was stunning, actually, how much white wine was being requested. Do you think that's going to go away? Is that hard to counter, or do you embrace that?
I fully embrace that. I mean, it's a little bit like painting with too broad a brush. Champagne is a universe unto itself. You know, there's a champagne for the heat of summer, and there's a champagne for the dead of winter. I think white wine's in a very similar boat, and I think as we we're very fortunate now to be uncovering or seeing wines from all of these places. You know, 10 years ago, there wasn't a whole lot of Chenin Blanc in California. Now it's everywhere. It's all over Instagram. It's all in every program. And that's a great thing because Chenin's one of those chameleon grapes that works in winter and certain examples work in summer. Riesling's kind of the same way. You know, I mean, I think that the breadth of wine that's available now is encouraging people to experiment and to broaden their drinking, which naturally leads to white wine.
Yeah. Well, and also if I could add, like, I'm the outsider, right? I immigrated here from New York City. I think it actually kind of mirrors the fact that you can go to a farmer's market 52 weeks a year in Southern California and have an incredible variety and incredible choices of stuff. Now, there's great farmer's markets in New York, but you're not going to have that 12 months a year variety because you've got frost and whatever. And so it's kind of the white wine comes into play in that same, it sort of mirrors that, right? You've got this incredible access and variety to all this farmer's market stuff year round. And so that's going to interact with white wine in a different way. It actually just gives you more, like kind of what Taylor was saying, more opportunity to try more interesting white wines.
Well, thank you so much, both of you. What a treat.
Thank you very much for having us. We look forward to seeing you at the restaurant.
Oh, I'll be there. That's Taylor Parsons and Michael Diamond of the Beastie Boys, a.k.a. Mike D. Along with Max Schnee, they've been helping to shape the wine list at April Bloomfield and Ken Friedman's new restaurant, Hearth & Hound. It opens in Hollywood next week.
We went to the Black Sea and we saw corn, and we were also like, what? Cornbread in Turkey? And then that started us thinking about how cuisines would differ as we move from region to region.
That's food and travel writer Robin Eckhart. We've been talking about her travels in Turkey and the astonishing diversity of flavors that she and her partner David Hagerman encountered from region to region. Robin's written about them in a new book of recipes called Istanbul and Beyond, which David photographed.
David and I visited in 1998 when we were living in Shanghai. We had 3 weeks of vacation. It was in the middle of winter, and award miles would get us to Istanbul. And we went without much preparation. I'm not even sure we had a guidebook. We spent about 8 days in Istanbul, and then we picked up a car and drove south and then east, eventually ending up in Antalya, which is on the Mediterranean. And we just fell in love and fell in love with the country, with the people, with its food. And about 8 months after that, we moved back to Berkeley, where we'd been living before, and I started studying Turkish at UC Berkeley. And it kind of went from there.
That's a pretty big commitment. That's true love.
It was. I knew that if I wanted to really know the place, I needed to speak the language. And I felt so strongly about it that I was just willing to throw myself into it.
And you as a documenter through images, David, what did Turkey give you that you were ready to see through the lens that you hadn't seen before?
In general, photography is about relationships, and the Turkish people were extremely warm and welcoming. I shoot a lot of food because food is sort of the doorway to get into cultures, and people are very willing to talk about food. And so for me, it was a matter of building up relationships and being out in the field where people are making food, people are doing things, harvesting and this kind of thing. And from that, I think we really got the idea that, you know, from the land comes the food. And I think a lot of the images that are in the book come from that particular place, trying to find where things came from. I'm sort of less interested in the final dish and the process of getting there.
It's interesting that you talk about the sense of place, because Turkey, even though it's so tiny, 13th the size of the U.S., it's incredibly diverse in topography. And, you know, I think of ingredients as just being equal to geography. How does the cuisine change as you leave Istanbul?
For this book, we concentrated on Istanbul and, as you mentioned in the intro, the eastern half of Turkey, because we wanted to look at the part of Turkey that most people don't get to. Even a lot of Turks don't travel in the eastern half. I guess what struck me as we were doing our research was, it was kind of a revelation. I mean, it shouldn't have been, but I was struck by the degree to which, in a way that we in America really can't even imagine, the degree to which what people eat is determined by where they live and the topography and climate of the area around them. And the degree to which locavorism is a thing, and it's not a thing because it's a thing. It's a thing because it's just always been. So, for instance, if you go to the Black...
And seasonality.
And seasonality. So if you go to the Black Sea coast, it's a bit like the Pacific Northwest, very wet climate, doesn't snow except in higher elevations, very lush, very green. Mainstays of the diet are obviously fish, corn, dried corn in all shapes and forms. Cornbread is a thing there. So, but you don't find that in the South. And if you go South, people say, oh, those Black Sea people, those corn eaters, because in the South, corn is animal feed. And I think that little example shows you just how much cuisines differ as you move from region to region.
The recipe I fixated on immediately was the roasted cornflour fondue.
Again, you know, it's about topography. The foothills there are very lush. They're perfect for grazing cows. And so dairy is also a major thing on the Black Sea. Cheese is produced. Black Sea butter is renowned throughout Turkey. And so this is, again, kind of encapsulates the cuisine in one single dish. As you've got the corn, you've got the dairy in the form of butter and in the form of cheese. You add a little water and some heat, and you've got this amazing, delicious, rich, corny fondue.
I can't wait to make that, actually, Because I think it's so interesting to think about this New World food having gone there and transformed. So many New World foods are emblematic of the foods of Turkey. Peppers everywhere.
Right, and eggplants.
So let's go back to Istanbul. I have not been lucky enough to be there. And my food friends just look at me, you know, just as if I am pathetic. And no one I know goes there without being absolutely blown away.
Yeah, I agree. Mm-hmm.
So give us an idea of what the flow of the day is and of different ways of eating there.
So you want to stay somewhere walking distance to the Bosphorus, because it's all about ferries in Istanbul. You should ride as many ferries as you can every single day. You get up. Most hotels serve buffets, and that's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. It's the breakfast buffet with butter, with kaymak, which is cream that's skimmed off the top of heated milk. It's usually buffalo kaymak, so it's especially rich, with honey drizzled over it, lots of preserves, tomatoes and cucumbers and olives and hard-boiled eggs. That's also part of the Turkish breakfast. And then you wander out. You might grab a simit, which are those braided bread rings that are sesame-coated, and we call them a Turkish bagel. And then, I mean, there's so many ways you can go eating in Istanbul. You can grab a grilled fish sandwich by the Bosphorus Sea, and it should be on the Karakoy side, not on the Eminönü side where the little touristy boats bob. Those are not the best sandwiches. You can go to, what you should do is you should go for lunch to an esnaf lokanta. It translates to working men's canteens. They're these very casual restaurants where things are served from a steam table. And I think Dave would agree, the first time we went to Istanbul and we poked our head in one of these places and we saw a steam table, we went, ew, you know, thinking like bad buffet, and didn't visit those places. But it turns out these places are where men, always men, prepare very home-style dishes. They're very affordable, and they're basically for workers, so they can have some home-style food to eat without going home at a good price. And they're the types of dishes that are meant to be, you know, long and slow. White bean stew with tomatoes, a roast lamb, just soups and stews that, if you can imagine them sitting on the back of a grandmother's stove, well, they're just on a steam table instead. And then, you know, for dinner, you can go out to, nowadays, a very lovely restaurant like Mikla or Nicole, that are run by Turkish chefs that have been trained in Europe but have come around to seeing the beauty of Turkish ingredients and are now using Turkish ingredients in amazing new ways.
One element of Turkish cuisine has always fascinated me. I've been introduced to it through Greek cooking and through Italian cooking. And I'm going to massacre this name, but zeytunyağlı, mm-hmm. This idea of foods that are braised in olive oil. Mm-hmm.
I think of it as poached or braised. Zeytunyağlı, zeytin is olive, and ya is oil. And when you add a l to the end of a word, it means e, like olive oily. So olive oily foods. Yes, you see that mostly on the West Coast and in Istanbul. Vegetables like eggplants, leeks, carrots, green beans, really anything can be braised in olive oil. And in most cases, these vegetables are cooked past a point that we in America tend to think of as appropriate. A zeytinyağlı fasulye, which is an oily green bean, is cooked for an hour and a half or 2 hours until the bean is absolutely soft and silky, and it's just delicious. Mm. You know, I don't cook my beans the same anymore. I don't do them crisp tender now that I've had a zeytinyağlı.
One of my favorite pictures in the book are of these two women bundled up, even though when I read the text, I discover it's summer, hanging really long pieces of pasta to dry, mm-hmm. on a clothesline. Mm-hmm. Tell me a bit about that encounter.
It was actually a bit random, as many of the encounters were. We were staying in Kars City, and we were planning on changing hotels. And we ended up walking down this particular alley, and these ladies were there, and they happened to be in front of this beautiful blue wall. And so we stopped, as I often do, as I always do, and we asked them if we could take some photos, and we did. And it turned out it's this erişte, this noodle that's made once a year, and they make them in the fall, and then they dry them, and then they take them to the wood-fired oven, and then you have this all winter.
And they're toasted. I'd only seen in Kars that they actually toast them. And they toast them till they're about the color of medium toast. I tasted a Finnish noodle, and it, you know, I could have eaten it straight. I mean, it was nicely salty. It had a nice weedy flavor and kind of like eating a noodle chip. I don't know. It was delicious. And then the way it's served is a specialty in Kars is wind-dried salted goose. And the way you eat this goose is you serve it over a bed of these noodles that are tossed with butter, which is a big deal in Kars because it is cow country, and lentils and green lentils.
Not too rich.
Not at all. It's winter. It's cold. So, yeah, again, you see how the climate has bearing on what people eat. They eat very heavily in the winter, and there aren't a lot of vegetables grown there. So it's a very rich, dairy-full diet in the winter, yeah.
Robin Eckhart writes on food and travel in Europe, Asia, and Turkey. Her first cookbook with photos by David Hagerman is called Istanbul and Beyond. Coming up, a look at the historic 7th Street Produce Market in downtown LA, celebrating 100 years. That's when the show continues.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman.
It was such a big deal that LA Times had an article where they said that it was the second largest wholesale terminal in the world at the time. At one point in time, about 10% of the country's produce had gone through this place.
That's writer Jean Trin. Grand Central Market in downtown LA recently held its centennial birthday bash, but a nearby institution also turned 100 with less fanfare. It's the historic 7th Street Produce Market, a longtime hub for fresh wholesale food in the downtown area. The market's still a staple for daily shoppers, but it's found a new life as home to the Smorgasburg Food Market. Jean dug through the market's archives to chronicle the changes over the years. It's such a gorgeous series of buildings.
Yeah, it's gorgeous and it's huge.
John Parkinson is the architect. What else did he design?
Oh, he designed like everything. There was Union Station, LA City Hall, the Memorial Coliseum, and even the building that houses Grand Central Market.
Pretty amazing. I think that a lot of people who go there these days for Smorgasburg have no idea that it's an actual working produce market the rest of the week.
Yeah, but they are starting to know about the 7th Street Produce Market, and that's kind of like the change that's happening. But, you know, since it's so different, it's like Sundays or just Smorgasburg. Nobody's coming in during the weekdays unless you're like a restaurateur or, you know, you own a market or something like that. But I've been talking to the vendors there, the produce vendors, and they've been noticing that there's more of a diverse crowd now. And there are people from who are regulars at Smorgasburg that are now coming into their markets.
That's pretty wonderful. How much land does the market cover?
It covers 5 acres.
And how many vendors are there?
There are 85.
What's so interesting to me about the vendors is who most of them are. Tell us a bit about what community most of them come from.
Yeah, so I was talking to Atlas Capital Group. They own this whole area, which is part of Row DTLA. And they were saying that from their records, it shows that 95% are Latino-owned businesses there. And of that, about 80% they think are Mexican descent.
It's really interesting. I mean, one could imagine that the people who started these businesses perhaps were assisting the previous generation. I think there were a lot of Greek produce vendors, produce people from other communities, and they ended up buying businesses.
Yeah, I talked to one produce vendor. His name's Carlos Franco, and he runs Elias Produce. And he was telling me that when his parents, they immigrated from Mexico, and when they came here in 1986, his dad was working for a Greek vendor, and that was his mentor. And basically, he learned everything he did from him. And it was about, he was saying around that time, all the Greek and Italian vendors were getting ready to retire, which is kind of like what's happening with his own parents right now. And at the time, his dad's mentor couldn't pronounce his name. His name was Isaias, so he called him Elias, and the name just stuck. And when he finally opened his own produce market, he called it Elias Produce.
What year did it open, and how vital was it to the country? Put the market sort of in perspective for us.
It first opened in 1917 in the fall. That was like the first phase. It took from 1917 to 1923 to build out everything. But John Parkinson built out the first produce markets at that time.
And it was called a terminal market because the rail yards sort of basically ended there.
Yeah, it was built right along the South Pacific Railroad line. So, yeah, that was the name for it back then. It was LA Terminal Market.
You know, so many of us, when we think of a produce market, we think of farmers markets. Wholesale markets are so different. Where is most of the produce that's sold at the market grown?
It would be Mexico, and then California, and then it goes into, like, South and Central America, and even Washington, Idaho.
The fact that we're seeing smorgasbord there on Sundays and the row being built out, how did the vendors respond to this new owner who obviously had very different plans?
Yeah, well, you know, I've talked to vendors who've said one thing, and I've also read from the LA Business Journal, they had this article and it came out May 2016, that some of the vendors were kind of concerned they didn't. This was 1 month before Smorgasburg opened, that they hadn't even heard from Atlas Capital Group that Smorgasburg was opening. So at that time, they were kind of, you know, a little worried and they didn't know. Fast forward to today, I've spoken to a few vendors who their feelings range from neutral to positive. Carlos Franco of Elias Produce says that he's seeing more diversity. So is Alberto Trujillo. He owns Superfresh. He said the same thing. They're seeing more diversity and more shoppers. They're people who are just coming in to shop for regular groceries, like just want to buy bulk produce to juice, or that they're making little projects. Like Carlos said that someone came in to get organic fruit to make organic popsicles. So they're seeing kind of more of that coming in. Also, some of the Smorgasburg vendors will buy produce from these vendors as well. I spoke to another woman, Erlinda Aguilar of El Centauro, and she's kind of neutral about it. She says it hasn't affected her business negatively or positively. She's seeing, like, other people getting helped out by it, but she says she hasn't seen any difference in her business.
There must have been rent hikes, though.
Yeah, there definitely were. Part of that LA Business Journal article, like, they're up to 20 to 24% price hikes for rent. And some people who had found out about it also said that when their lease was up, they were having longer leases, like about 5 years. And when this happened, when their lease ran up, they were getting leases for about 1 year. So it was like shorter and more expensive. And some were afraid. Some have moved out, you know, some like struggle. Some of the produce vendors I've spoken to seem to, they, on the other hand, just think that all of the rents are increasing downtown, Boyle Heights, like everywhere. And they've also said that they are seeing a change in the produce market, that it's getting cleaner, that it's more approachable now. Alberto was telling me that he thought that, it, like, back before Atlas Capital Group came in, it was more just like you're selling a quantity and, you know, just bulk, trying to just sell out the product. And he said now it seems like they're trying to build an identity or sort of a brand. So some of them are okay with it. Some are upset. Some have moved. But the problem about moving is that the 7th Street Produce Market is such an iconic place and everyone goes there for it. So when people go and move their markets to other produce markets, they've found that, you know, they're not selling as much because there's not as much foot traffic or prominence.
Has Atlas come out to say that they're committed to maintaining the market?
They have. I mean, I've spoken to Juan Santana. He's the property manager there. And he said that he's committed. He's not trying to push people out. People are afraid, or from that Business Journal article, I could see that people were afraid about it. But he says that's not his plan. They had a centennial celebration in early November, and it was like a party for the vendors and the public, and, you know, it was like a celebration, and it seemed like it was for them, too. So I feel like they're trying to celebrate them as well.
That's great. To imagine it being empty would just be devastating.
Yeah.
And it's hard to imagine anything that could fill a space that large.
Yeah, I don't think anything could replace it. Alberto was telling me that, you know, he's like a second-generation owner, and his parents opened it up in the early 90s. And he said for him, like, he could tell that the neighborhood's changing. And for him, he'd rather that the 7th Street Produce Market change along with the changing demographics of the city. He'd rather that than lose the market because it means so much to him. So he thinks that they should change as well.
Have you found yourself going and shopping there?
Yeah, I just went to the centennial party, and I realized that I now want to just shop there.
It's funny because I didn't realize that I could go as a home cook and just buy a case of this or that. That's kind of dangerous for me to know.
Yeah, you might be making a bunch of pies.
There you go. That's writer Jean Trin. She recently wrote a piece for the LA Weekly about the evolution of the 7th Street produce market, which turned 100 this fall. Now a visit from Jonathan Gold, who's here to tell us about a new restaurant. Where are we going today, sir?
We are going to the fascinating city of Bell.
Oh, okay. So what's new culinarily happening in Bell?
In the location that used to be Corazon y Miel, the wonderful Mexican restaurant, is now another Mexican restaurant, this time called Tacos y Mezcal.
And who's the person behind that?
It's someone we've talked about on the show kind of a lot. Her name is Rocio Camacho. She's known for her moles. She had moles la tia. She worked for a while at Casita Mexicana.
So now she's opened a place that doesn't focus on moles, but I'm sure there must be moles, right?
There is one sort of token chicken mole you can get. But it's not really a chicken mole. It's like a chicken with some mole.
That's so interesting because you would imagine that she would worry that people would be seeking out mole from her.
And I'm sure that they are, but she has in Bell Gardens, which isn't so very far away, a restaurant that does have a lot of moles in it. So I guess she doesn't want to split the market. And this is in a old cocktail lounge on a very busy street. It's very dark. It's very long. The bar is very much part of the program, you know, thus the mezcal in the name, thus the longest list of Mexican craft beers, probably more than I've ever seen anywhere else, actually, at least on tap.
They're quite good.
They are.
What are we going to eat?
You're probably going to start with an appetizer or two. She does a really good version of street corn, which is something everybody on earth is doing these days. But she really gets a nice black, crunchy char on the outside of the whole corn cob. There's big mounds of octopus salad with chopped onions and avocado and some citrus in there, and these sort of par-fried thick tortillas to dip them up with, which is nice. And a really good, you know, guacamole. I guess you'd expect every place would have guacamole, but they seem to take a bit of care with it. They sprinkle it with pepitas, and it's served with those same flexible semi-chip, semi-tortilla things.
That's interesting.
I think it is. I mean, we're also used to getting those absolutely hard-fried, thin tortillas to go with, you know, ceviches and things like that. So it's nice to be able to do this.
And then once we have sated ourselves with appetizers and we've had our first drink, will we be just basically drinking the mezcal straight, or are we having a cocktail?
They have cocktails, including what they call Oaxacan Old Fashioned, which is basically a mezcal and tequila Old Fashioned, which is pretty good to eat. The mezcal selection is interesting. They have a couple of shelves of them, but there's no mezcal menu and there's no price list. So you've sort of got to close your eyes and point or have somebody recommend one. And occasionally the one you think is the most delicious ends up being $32 a shot. But if you drink a lot of mezcal, you know that's the way it goes.
Yeah, more and more. The rest of the menu must be taco-centered with the name in the title.
It has two parts with considerable overlap. One is cazuelas, which, you know, is traditionally that flat clay pot that sizzles thing in the oven. Here, that's replaced by cast iron pans, which is cute. And you can get, like, a stew of nopales, of cactus with crunchy fried grasshoppers, if such is your thing. There's an alambre, which is not the super cheesy one you find in Mexico City-style restaurants, but more focused on the meat and the onions, probably. There's chunks of swordfish with poblanos and something called chili ajo, which I hadn't really had before, but I guess it's a stewed pork shoulder.
With a lot of chili and garlic?
With a lot of chili and garlic.
That sounds pretty great.
You know, it's good to go with somebody who hasn't been before because then you can find a way to hoard all the whole roasted garlic cloves for yourself.
And is this a restaurant where the level of heat is pretty intense?
Actually, nothing is really that hot at all. sometimes, as in their Cochinita de Pibil, I sort of like longing for that habanero sauce that just knocks you absolutely backwards, you know, that you get at places like Chichen Itza or in Chichen Itza. But there's homemade salsas that come served in a wooden spoon that's balanced on the plank, which is very cute, but not enough for people who have burned their tongues out on years of scotch bonnets and habaneros and scorpion peppers. Of course, it's being tacos y mezcal, tacos are a big part of the program. The tortillas are handmade, and they come hot, and they're good. You also get tacos with the cazuelas, so you can make your own little mini tacos. They come in a few different categories on the menu, but there are basically two. One is with big tortillas, so the taco is substantial. Probably the amount of food you'd get in an average burrito. Some of my favorites in that are filled with strips of milanesa, which is the, you know, breaded fried beef, or with nubs of pan-grilled steak and guacamole, or with that mixture of chorizo and melted cheese that is called choriqueso. Choriqueso sounds so exotic until you go to Tijuana and you realize that it's what everybody is eating.
Yeah, it's so good, though.
And then they have a section of tacos they call from Bell, California, that are essentially street tacos. So the big ones are like $5-6 each, and the smaller ones are 3 for $10. And those can be filled with what they call lechon, but it's roast pork. It's a little bit crispy, almost to dryness, but it's still really good. Or with that chili ajo, or with barbacoa. Those are worth getting. And because we are living in the decade we are living in, there are also some vegan tacos that are quite good, actually. One of them is filled with corn and tomatoes and zucchini blossoms and such. The other one, which you absolutely wouldn't expect, is of jackfruit. Oh, and I should probably also mention the desserts. They have really delicious churros, smaller than usual, sort of cut in a jagged way, very crisp, stuffed with custard and put in, I guess you'd call it a tequila-spiked creme anglaise.
Well, thank you very much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
That's Jonathan Gold on tacos and mezcal in Bell. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. Text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. In a minute, we talk to a journalist who experienced the dangers of working in restaurant kitchens as a woman. Now she's speaking out. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW.
I had read Kitchen Confidential, I'd read Heat, you know, I'd read all these chef memoirs that made it very clear that the culture of restaurant kitchens is and always has been this sort of no rules apply, very sexualized place. And I felt like going into that, that was what I was going to have to deal with. So I wasn't surprised by it.
In 2010, journalist Tracy McMillan took a kitchen job at a New York Applebee's in order to write about her experience. During her tenure, she encountered the dark and ugly underside of kitchen culture, that it can be far from a safe place for women. She wrote about it in an op-ed for the New York Times. Was this experience working at Applebee's the first restaurant experience you had had?
This was not my first restaurant experience. In high school, I worked at a Big Boy and I waitressed through college. So I've worked in a number of restaurants, never worked at any sort of high-end place. And Applebee's really is the first place I had worked after Kitchen Confidential had come out, you know, which I had certainly read and enjoyed like a lot of other folks. And you know, when I went to work at Applebee's, I really felt like, okay, this is great. I'm like going to go in and be like a tough woman who can hold her own, can give as good as she gets. And I'm just going to play along and survive. And it'll, as long as I have a thick skin, I'll be fine.
For the most part, is that what happened?
I mean, for the most part, I guess you could say that. I mean, certainly, you know, I was not getting physically attacked on a daily basis in the kitchen, right? That wasn't happening. But every day, almost every day, people would make jokes to me that would never fly in a more respected workplace, right? So if I bent over to pick something up off the floor in the kitchen, a server would come in and tell me, oh, you can't do that in front of me. I don't know what I'll do, right? And you would never accept that, you know, in an office environment. Or I would burn my hand on the line and somebody would like come up and start massaging me with ice, sort of without me asking and things like that. So things happened that I felt like I had under control and that were okay. But, you know, as I sort of document both in the book and in the op-ed, right, like eventually that stuff catches up with you because you can't really tell who's just talking for show and who's actually, you know, creepy.
Did the constant barrage of this kind of lewd behavior surprise you?
I can't say that I was really surprised by the lewd behavior. I think really for me, the thing that surprised me was that having a thick skin wasn't actually enough to protect me.
So let's talk about that, because you actually did experience an assault that was extremely premeditated.
In some ways it was premeditated, in other ways it wasn't. I mean, this is in the op-ed, but it can be easy to skim over. So what had happened is that on my last night at the restaurant, we were all drinking on the line, which was something that happened, you know, frequently when people were leaving or things like that. And one of the cooks at the restaurant drugged my drink, or at least this is what somebody told me like a month later. I end up going out with a bunch of my coworkers. Somebody had seen the drink get drugged and did not tell me, but told another woman that she should go along and keep an eye on me. And she did. And what happened was that, we ended up at somebody's apartment hanging out. And the guy who I am told drugged my drink tried to take me home with him. And she prevented that from happening. She kept him from leaving with me. And then somebody else took advantage of the situation. And after I passed out, sort of did things with me that I have no idea what they did.
What a horrible experience.
Yeah, that was not a fun morning for me.
Let's talk about this idea. I mean, I think for so many of us, reading Kitchen Confidential, when it first came out, was sort of like this breath of fresh air of honesty and a celebration on one level of this piratical behavior that felt good in a strange way. I think for people who feel like they don't fit in nine to five kind of jobs, they felt like they were allowed to exist in this one environment. But you say you feel that the book sort of led to permission for a lot of really bad behavior.
Yeah, I think that that's true. And I want to say, right, like I didn't feel oppressed or put upon by having to deal with that stuff in the workplace, right? Like there's a part of me that really enjoys sort of transgressing social norms, right? And being mouthy and swearing and doing all of that. You know, that's part of what I really enjoyed about restaurant work. That was my favorite job that I had during that book project. What I just sort of came out of it feeling like is that it ultimately isn't really conscionable to treat that as being the default and acceptable culture in a place, especially as restaurants become a bigger and bigger part of our economy. It feels to me in some ways sort of like the smoking ban, right? Where it's like, oh, we should be able to smoke. We should be able to have this and that. And then you start to think about this. Well, actually, that's a workplace, right? Is it appropriate to require everybody who works at a restaurant to put themselves at sort of a health risk of secondhand smoke and all the things that come with that? And, you know, we've been increasingly deciding as a country, like, no. And I think we might be at a point where we can say, like, look, like restaurants are workplaces. It's not really cool to make them places where it's so sexualized.
Restaurants are in such a different place than they were a generation ago. First of all, there's such a huge employer now, and particularly of women, that it seems like this desire to not grow up kind of has to go away.
Yeah, I feel like that's where I'm coming to with this. You know, I think restaurants are great places, and I love the camaraderie and sort of the culture of kitchens, like the sort of family stuff, like that's all great, but they are professional workplaces. And I think we've accepted them as being not really having to be professional in part because they were kind of marginal. But today, I mean, restaurants are one of the largest employers in the country. 4.7 million women work in them. We need to make sure that they're places where people are not being sexualized sort of as a matter of course, right? I mean, we would never put up with that stuff in an environment where people were being paid like better salaries or had been, you know, sort of by default have college educations to be in those places. And there's no reason to expect that sort of women making $8 and $10 an hour deserve to be treated with any less respect.
And I think about the women who work in places that are not dining palaces of the coasts where they're walking with, you know, $300 a night. But we're talking about places where really it's survival wages. A lot of the women working there are single women or single mothers and are vulnerable and would tend to not go to a boss to complain.
Yeah, I mean, there is a real penalty to going to your boss to complain, right? Because even if you're in the right, you're somebody who's making a mess and having to call attention to yourself. And that's nothing anybody wants to do, particularly if you need a job to survive. I felt that very strongly at Applebee's, and I didn't technically need that job, right? Like, one of the things that, you know, I'm sort of grateful about how my experience unfolded is that it was at the end of the time that I was working there. So I could make the choice that I wasn't going to go to the restaurant and complain and talk about this stuff. I could just be like, I'm not going to deal with this. I don't have time for this, and sort of tuck it away until I could. And if I had been a single mom working at Applebee's, that wouldn't have been an option.
A lot of people have been focusing on Kitchen Confidential and Anthony Bourdain as sort of ground zero of the celebration of this kind of overly sexualized behavior. What do you think about his response in Slate?
I mean, I thought his response was kind of a cop-out, honestly. It's great that he feels bad. He has a huge mouthpiece. He has 6 million, like, Twitter followers. If he feels so bad, like, he could start telling men not to behave like this. For me, like, to hear somebody of Bourdain's status saying, well, men are always going to be like this, so women just need to step up and talk about it, that's putting all of the blame really on women for their situation, right? Like, that it's, well, it's your fault if you don't speak up. And I just, it's important, obviously, to listen to women when they speak up, but we'll get a lot farther, a lot faster if the men, particularly the men who have profited off of this, right, and gained huge recognition and power from behaving that way, if they can sort of stand up a little bit and say, you know, that's actually really not cool, and I don't think people should be doing that, and we should stop doing that. I mean, that would matter a lot more than saying, yeah, I was being a jerk before, and gosh, like, I hope we fix it. I mean, he could do something to fix it.
Well, thank you so much, Tracy. I appreciate you coming on.
Thanks, Evan. Take care.
Tracy McMillan is a senior fellow at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism and author of The American Way of Eating. In October, she wrote for the New York Times about her experience of sexual assault in the kitchen. In a moment, we close our show with a celebrity pastry chef who's bringing his trademark product to LA. I mean, literally trademarked. Don't go anywhere.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. How often is something completely new invented in the kitchen? Not often, I'm here to tell you. It's rare. The croissant donut mashup called the Cronut comes close, and it just landed in LA. I've been catching up with the pastry chef behind the Cronut, Dominique Ansel. We're at his new bakery and restaurant at the Grove called 189 by Dominique Ansel. Hi.
Hi.
How lovely to see you here.
Nice to see you too. Thank you for coming.
How much time did you spend in LA before you decided to open an outpost here?
So I've been back and forth close to 3 years. And I've been coming quite a lot, like exploring food and seeing what's happening in Los Angeles, which is a city that I absolutely love. You know, I lived here permanently. I'm going to spend my time between New York and Los Angeles since we have a home now.
Because you also have a store in Tokyo. So actually spending time here, you can justify it.
That's right. It's even closer to Tokyo. So we have two bakeries in New York, one in London, two in Tokyo. And now we just opened Los Angeles, our bakery, and our first restaurant.
Yeah, actually we're sitting right here in the restaurant. It's a gorgeous room. More than 30% of your menu was developed exclusively for Los Angeles. We're a strange bunch out here. What did you feel you had to take into consideration?
Well, this was for the bakery. The 30% is for the bakery. Taking into consideration the cultural mix, the diversity of ethnicity, the food excitement, the quality, the market, a lot of things were taken in consideration for me to, I think, understand and fit into Los Angeles.
Could you give me an example of something that you put on the menu here that you don't have in other places?
Sure. We created this little mousse cake that is called California Roll that consists into an almond, toasted almond mousse, and inside there's honey jelly and an avocado mousse. So it tastes a little bit savory, it's still sweet, and on the outside, it looks like a graphic design version of a California Roll with little pieces of chocolate decor.
It's very cute.
Thank you.
Where'd the name of the restaurant come from, 189?
189 comes from our address first here. We are at 189 The Grove Drive. But also reverse back to our really first bakery in New York City on Spring Street, which is located at 189 Spring Street. And it was a coincidence in the
beginning.
That's
so odd. So let's talk about the restaurant. What made you, are you just sick of sugar?
I'm not. I will never be. I love sugar. I'm like in love with sugar, and I will be for the rest of my life. The restaurant is, was a dream of mine. It was a great opportunity here since it's a much larger space, and which we don't have in New York. It's an exciting time for me because I was actually trained as a chef. My very first job, I was a chef, savory chef for about 2 years, and I started cooking versus baking. I went to baking a little bit later. I always love cooking and never ever stop cooking at home for my friends, my family. It's something that, you know, I'm passionate about. So here we've come up with a really fun and eclectic menu using, you know, French roots as techniques, but it's not French food. It's more modern American and very eclectic style of cooking.
Describe one dish.
So we have this beautiful rotisserie chicken, and I've worked with our executive chef. He was born in Korea, grew up in Argentina. We wanted to do a rotisserie chicken, but not a simple one, not just a regular one. So I grew up going to market with my family once a week, at least once a month, when my mom had money, and we'll buy this rotisserie chicken. I remember still, like, it was like so hot in the bag. I would like burn myself, carry it home. It smells so good, the flavor of it, the temperature. I would go home, like, rip half the bag and have all this like burst of flavor, and I going down and eating this chicken, and I loved it. And our chef Hyun actually grew up drinking sanggaetang, which is the chicken that is cooked in the broth, where you pick the meat and you add salt and pepper. So we came up with our rotisserie chicken, which we do with chili butter that we rub underneath the skin. So with chili, like spicy chicken. We serve it with black garlic rice, and really, really tasty, like deep, rich flavor. And also a scallion salad, the Korean style, with a spicy dressing. So it's like meaty, there's a bit of starch, because it's the rich flavor of black garlic. There's also this very light, spicy salad. It works really, really well together. We serve it with a shot of chicken jus on the side, which is like, you know, like this nice little warm thing that you drink at the end. And it's one of my favorite dish.
It sounds wonderful. One of the things I noticed on Instagram was this series of desserts that you're doing that has a very interesting theme. You're focusing on very basic chef techniques as the base point to create these beautiful creative dishes. Could you describe a couple of them for us?
Sure. I think for me it was important when I developed this entire menu, savory, but also the dessert menu, to have an extension of each other and to make sure that the food matches the desserts. We have one that's called the well. It looks like a well of flour with yolks inside.
Like what you used to make pasta in
exactly. The
old traditional way.
Like you used to make pasta in the beginning. You put your flour on the bench, you do a well, you put your eggs in there. So it looks exactly like this. But it's also the beginning of every dough.
So what is
course.
It made out of? What
it's
is the white?
It's made of a mix of three different milks. It looks like flour. It's actually shaved ice, granita. Not very sweet granita. So it's milk flavor. And we also use a honey jelly. So it's a play on milk and honey. And we added, to mimic the yolks, some passion fruit gelée as well.
And then you had another one that was sort of an ode to knife skills.
Mm-hmm. Knife skills, so it's an apple dessert that shows all the basic skills that we learn when you go to culinary school. All the basics, julienne, brunoise, also the quenelle, that is like perfect quenelle, this beautiful ribbon of apple that is like drizzled with lemon thyme syrup. We also have a dessert that's called the trimmings. My favorite part of, you know, working in the kitchen, always have some trimmings of cakes here and there when you cut out. And what do you do with the trimmings? We eat them in the kitchen, of course. We keep them for ourselves as a chef, and we eat them in the kitchen. I wanted to share these trimmings with our guests. So one of the desserts is called trimmings, and we serve it with a little brush and some rum syrup and also a sieve filled with cocoa powder. So we ask you to brush yourself your own trimmings with the syrup and to finish it off with a little bit of cocoa powder. So you're part of the finishing touch in the kitchen.
The baking community in LA is a super tight-knit group. And over the course of the next while, well, Italy has just opened. You've come. Tartine is going to open a huge space. Is there room for everybody, do you think?
There's room for everybody. I'm excited. I'm excited to be a part of it. I'm excited to be here. I'm always, you know, to me, it's, when people ask me, it's not competition. It's like a community. It's friends. It's co-workers. It's people that you keep around you, like you see, you know, you see them all the time. I had Nancy Silverstone here the other day, and I love her. I love what she does, you know. I love everything she's done. She's built in Los Angeles. You know, we're friends. It's not about competition. It's not about having a room. Of course, there's room for everyone. All of us each have a different and unique and distinct style. And I think there's more bakery, the better it is. The better it is for our community, the better it is for our customers, the better it is to vehicle the message of what we love.
That was Chef Dominique Ancel. He was recently named World's Best Pastry Chef by the World's 50 Best Restaurants. His cookie shots, Queen Amon, and frozen s'mores are finally here in L.A. Find them at his new bistro at The Grove called 189 by Dominique Ancel. That's it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, you can listen to the show on our website or on KCRW's mobile app or even on Spotify. You can also download our show wherever you get your podcasts. As always, many thanks to the Good Food team, Nick Liao, Lyril Garcia, Rosalie Atkinson, Joseph Stone, Joel Stein, and Ronnie Mickelson. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I will be back here next week with you for more good food.